So, good morning, and welcome. Thanks for coming. I think the Isthmus put it really, really well when they said this week, when even your presidential candidates don't believe in evolution, it's time for Darwin Day. So, it's time for Darwin Day. I'm Dana Geary. I'm a paleontologist in the Department of Geology and Geophysics and the chair of the Darwin Day Organizing Committee. Our logo this year that you can see up in front of you, nicely designed by Laura Mitchell, is the Tree of Life. The Tree of Life represents, of course, the shape of evolution. Its single trunk represents our single common ancestor, and from it, this explosion, the amazing diversity of life, with, as represented here by a subset, the millions of species that we have on the planet. I think that virtually everyone has a sense of wonder and awe at this spectacular diversity of life, whether it's the march of penguins, or the hoot of an owl on a zero-degree night, the unfolding of a flower, the eye of a trilobite. Whatever it is that delights you, I think virtually everyone is delighted by something in this diversity. Where people differ, I think, is in their response to this sense of wonder, what they ascribe it to, and what they do with it. What distinguishes scientists, I think, is their desire to push at it, at this compelling edge of what we know and what we don't know, to explore how it all works, and to learn something about its deep history. Depictions of scientists in the movies or on TV never come close to capturing this strong emotional connection between scientists and what they study. But this sense of wonder and delight are only increased by a deeper understanding of the workings of the natural world. I think every scientist I know feels this way. So today is about evolutionary biologists working at the frontiers of evolutionary research, communicating to you, whatever your walk of life, a deeper sense of how the biological world works and how it has come to be the way it is. And we hope that this will enhance your sense of joy and also your sense of responsibility at this discovery of how the world works. So our first speaker today is Professor Don Waller from the Department of Botany. In each of the last 2 years of Darwin Day, we've had a question from the audience, surprising to me, and it was the same question both years, which was basically, so why do we need to save all these species anyway? And I never felt like we completely addressed that, or we were ready to address that on the spot. And so this year I thought we should address it and put it in an evolutionary context right up front. And it was clear to me from the beginning that there was no one better to do this than Don Waller. Don is a preeminent evolutionary biologist. He's done really important work on the evolution of plant mating systems. He served as the editor of Evolution. He is currently the president for the Society for the Study of Evolution. And Don also wears a different hat. He's done extremely important work as a conservation biologist, including studying the ecology of forest communities in Wisconsin and the impact of deer browsing. Don has studied jewelweed, or impatience, but his work shows no evidence of impatience. He's one of the most thoughtful scientists I know. With respect to the Tree of Life, some might say that humans are attacking it with a wood chipper these days. Don takes a more measured and thoughtful approach in his title today, which is Reshaping the Tree of Life, Human Impacts on the Future of Evolution. So, Don.
Thanks very much, Dana. And it's a real honor and pleasure to be here today. And thank you for the nice introduction. I'm glad you emphasized delight and a sense of wonder, because I think those are things we should emphasize in what we do. A disclaimer up front, I'm going to venture into the realm of macroevolution, where I'm patently unqualified to discuss anything, being in fact a microevolutionist, but then I've done that in ecology too. Why do evolutionists do what we do? I think we're drawn to pretty places, unusual species, endemic birds, whales, the tuatara in New Zealand. That's what got many of us into the field. These twigs on the tree of life, the particulars at the tip. And we're here today in part to celebrate our science and the beauty and grandeur of this tree of life. We're also here to celebrate the impressive successes and recent advances in our field. Evolutionary biology has a lot to be proud of, and in many ways we're coming into a golden age, I think, of our own science. However, we do face a few impediments on our way to that golden age. And I'm not trying to just be flip here, although cards like this are engaging and provocative. It's remarkable to me that the most monumental event of our age, the massive extinction we're in the middle of, is conspicuously absent from the presidential debates and discussion. I really think this should be brought to everyone's attention and grounds a lot of what I want to say to you. By the way, the rest of this card made even more sense. So, is evolution political? Well, I don't know why there should be a difference between political parties in views towards a basic science like evolution. But apparently there is. And I think we should all give this some thought too, what it is that people feel threatened by. Because it really isn't about the science. It's a question of beliefs and what people think the implications of the science are. So I'll start by talking about attitudes towards evolution, and then a little bit about how evolution works in a micro and in a macro sense, as a lead up to discuss the big topic here, namely how we are using our hedge trimmers or our scissors or our chainsaws to prune away at the tree of life. I'll try and emphasize that evolution, that these twigs and branches on the tree of life, have an important ecological and biogeographic context. And that has important meaning for us in terms of what we will be able to save and where we'll be able to save it. And that we're losing that context, and that itself represents a distinct threat. And then we'll talk briefly about what I know even less about, namely the regrowth of twigs on the tree of life, which is certainly going to happen after our current extinction spasm. But that, of course, is purely speculative. But first, let's rejoice in what evolutionary biology is bringing us these days. We have a profusion of genetic and genomic data. We have new markers. We have ultra-rapid sequencing machines. We have the field of metagenomics, where results from polymerase chain reaction can give us new insights into the previously invisible and masked diversity on the microbial level. I have to mention that here, of course. The organisms that inhabit the guts of animals, the soil. We have data resources like GeneBank and BLAST searches that allow us to understand homology and duplication of genes through the history of life. We have new methods for building evolutionary trees and reconstructing phylogenies. We have the Tree of Life Project itself, which was the basis for this tree that you see here. And this has brought some remarkable new insights and discoveries. This is Norman Pace's tree that makes clear that most of the tree of life is microbial, that humans are more closely related to yeast than they are to corn. There are more genetic differences between E. coli and bacillus than there are between us and paramecia. And this is from Ken Todar, who works in this building and department. This three domains of life is completely different from what I learned in high school, which had, you know, at that time the five kingdom idea was a new trendy approach. I think we're going to learn a lot more details about how this tree is constructed, but in the big picture scheme of things, this is where you are. We now have the ability to map and dissect quantitative traits via what are called quantitative trait loci. We can look at responses to selection. We can predict responses to selection, correlated and direct. We have the whole field of evolution and development, linking the genetics of developmental events to morphology and structure, the comparative genetics of homeobox genes, cis-regulatory elements, and other components of what my colleague Sean Carroll calls the genetic toolkit. Furthermore, we have popular interest in evolution at an all-time high. Popular magazine articles, Scientific American, Science judged it the hot topic of the year a year or two ago, nature shows on TV, which don't always get it right, by the way, gee whiz stories, we all have our favorite adaptations, and of course we have metaphors all the time about evolution, even appearing on the cover of the New Yorker magazine. This was actually a triptych. The middle frame looked like this. You can see the progress and industrial man standing there at the height of it all just before. And I think this is a good metaphor to start with because it represents, I think, a fairly accurate position of where we may be. Remember that growth is always most rapid just before a crash in populations subject to overshoot. At the same time, it might be called the worst of times for evolution. We've got so many in the public that are disturbed or upset about the idea that humans are evolved from apes, that we are animals. I'm not sure why this makes people upset or disquieted. I often take comfort in this. But it leads many to reject the science of evolution. And there's a real disconnect here between scientists and the general public, which indicates we have a big job to do in terms of sharing our results and the structure of our science with a broader audience. And yet, just at a time when we need it even more, the teaching of evolution is being countered by strong efforts like the one that led to the firing of Chris Comer in the Texas Board of Education recently. It also can lead to some interesting contradictions, sort of exceptionalism, where people accept microevolution but not macroevolution, or all of evolution except for the Triassic period. So other people have argued that, well, evolution is passé, it's really all over. Freeman Dyson, an innovative technological thinker, has argued that after 3 billion years, the Darwinian era is over. Cultural evolution is 1,000 times faster. We have cultural interdependence we call globalization. And now in the last 30 years, Homo sapiens has revived the ancient pre-Darwinian practice of horizontal gene transfer, moving genes from microbes to plants and animals, blurring the boundaries between species. He's predicting do-it-yourself kits. Let's genetically engineer new organisms for our greenhouses. Genetic engineering, once it gets into the hands of the general public, will give us an explosion of biodiversity. Not to worry. This is a techno-ergon that it's in full flower. At the opposite extreme, you've got several people who are worried about the opposite. Not the beginning of do-it-yourself evolution, but the end of evolution in nature. We've got the founding father of conservation biology, Michael Soule, and Terry Glavin, a Canadian journalist and author of Waiting for the Macaws, suggesting that especially larger animals, the big ungulates and the predators and species endemic to islands and shrinking habitats, are seeing the end game, the end of time. And even for a much broader class of plants and animals, we may be seeing an end to wildness, to wild conditions, a situation that might allow them to continue their evolution. Evolution is changing track, and evolution is affected strongly by the context it operates in. And humans, representing now the predominant species on Earth, have radically changed selective conditions for all other life on the planet. So attitudes vary, everything from, you know, the techno-optimism and golden age of evolutionary biology, the anti-evolutionists, people who feel threatened by it, those that worry about evolution being over. But I'll also have another thesis to make today, and that's that evolution is really just getting going. So let's start by asking, what is evolution? Apologies for those of you who teach this. Most people equate evolution with natural selection. That was Darwin's fundamental insight, of course. And that's based on the Malthusian insight that all populations have a capacity for indefinite increase at a geometric rate. This quickly allows them to outstrip whatever resources might be available to them, leading to a struggle for existence. Individuals furthermore vary in terms of their constitution. Some survive and reproduce better than others. And importantly, this is the part my students sometimes get wrong, some of that variation must be heritable, have a genetic basis. And the result of those combinations of facts and factors means that there will be differential survival and reproduction among individuals, that will tend to lead to changes in allele and gene frequency, and that's what we call natural selection. Got it all? Okay. But that's not all that there is to evolution. Evolution occurs via other mechanisms at different levels and scales of selection. To begin with, we know much more about selfish genes, selfish genetic elements, including transposable elements, particular genes that distort the segregation of chromosomes or genes into gametes, viral insertions, and so forth. At the population level, much of the genetic change that we see, particularly in small and isolated populations, is due not to the action of selection, but rather to genetic drift, which leads to the unavoidable fixation of genes, many of which turn out to be deleterious and damaging. And you also have at least the potential for selection among groups in species that live in groups in a way there's competition and differential survival or reproduction of groups. And finally, and this is something that paleontologists like Niles Eldredge and Stephen Jay Gould have emphasized, you have, again, at least the potential, which I'll argue is realized at particular episodes in the Earth's history, for selection among species, what we call species selection. This could be a strong driver of macroevolutionary trends, but it tends to get ignored by microevolutionists. The time when it's going to be most pronounced, of course, are during these episodes of mass extinction. That is, what species managed to make it through one of these cataclysmic extinction events is going to have a lot to do with what the tree of life is going to look like after that cataclysmic extinction. We've had some doozies. Artists get carried away with trying to imagine what it must have been like for a 20-kilometer asteroid moving at a couple of hundred thousand miles or kilometers per second to have splashed into the Yucatan Peninsula and the Gulf of Mexico 63 million years ago, the KT boundary. But that wasn't the only mass extinction event. Yes, it's the one that drove the dinosaurs extinct, but the one that really gives me cause to ponder and think is the Permian extinction, which eliminated a very large fraction of marine invertebrate families, and it's estimated by some up to 90 or 95% of the species alive on Earth at the time. In other words, we came this close, perhaps, to losing life on Earth altogether. We can also learn from more recent extinction events, and I think there were multiple waves of extinction that humans have observed or participated in more directly. If you go back just 15 or 20,000 years on this continent, you would have found that we would have an American Serengeti here. We had more species and genera of large mammals than any other continent on the face of the planet. We now have the fewest number of large mammals of any continent on the planet. A huge number of these, over 40 genera of large mammals, went extinct, coincidentally with the migration of humans across the Bering Land Bridge or by sea into North and South America about 12 or 14,000 years ago. I sometimes wonder if that's why many Indian tribes have a great respect for nature and their power over it, if their ancestors witnessed these kinds of extinction events in the space of a few generations. This did not only occur in North and South America. Those who question whether it really was humans or whether it was some climatic change, I think ignore the coincidence in time and place between the extinction of very large vertebrates, often birds and reptiles as well as mammals, with the arrival of humans on Madagascar, on New Zealand, in Australia, on Hawaii, and that archipelago. It's such a consistent pattern that I think Martin's overkill hypothesis has to be accepted. Furthermore, we've got some interesting sort of evolutionary anachronisms that are leftovers from this time. We have a pronghorn antelope out west that can run at 60 or 70 miles per hour and can run at 30 for up to 15 miles. There's no other animal on this continent that can run that fast. Why does it do this? And the answer is that it used to be chased by a cheetah. We had a North American cheetah. We had a North American lion bigger than the African lion. We had dire wolves. We had gomphotheres. We had saber-toothed cats, smilodonts. And those are all gone. So we have some evolutionary questions that these extinctions leave us with. It turns out that species on islands are peculiarly sensitive to extinction, and especially human-caused extinctions. It turns out we talk about evolutionary naivete with regard to the animals that live on these animals. The boobies or the tortoises or whatever it is stand there until humans walk up and club them to death. Now, we've also got an enigma. Why did North America suffer such a huge loss of these large mammals? Why did Asia and Eurasia suffer a lesser loss? And why did Africa experience a lesser loss compared to these other continents? So why are all the big hairies dead except African big hairies? Why do we have to go to the Serengeti or Kruger National Park in Africa to see these big mammals? And it's interesting to ask that question. I think most of us who are evolutionary biologists realize that humans co-evolved with large mammals in Africa over a large period of time, and humans in Africa also co-evolved with a larger suite of parasites and pathogens than in other parts of the world that may have helped keep human numbers in check. But most importantly, I think the changes, the increase in technology of human cultures happened at a pace in Africa that somehow allowed co-evolution to occur and prevented those mass extinctions that we saw elsewhere. In other words, the rate of change is at least as important as the full nature of change. Now, as Dana alluded to, haven't extinctions always happened? Why should we worry about the extinctions that are going on now or ones that went on in the recent geological history? Well, the answer is because we're in a mass extinction now. And it's the first and only mass extinction that's ever been caused by one other species. There's no other species in the history of life on Earth that has ever had hegemony over global resources the way humans have. The human species monopolizes for its own use some 40% of the world's net terrestrial net primary productivity, estimated by Peter Vitusek and colleagues, for food, clothing, shelter, amusement, recreation. No other species in the history of life on Earth has ever commandeered anything like 40% of those world resources. And correspondingly, we have extinction rates now that have accelerated by 100 or 1,000 times. So let's look at what species we're losing here, because that's a good indication of how the tree of life is going to be changing. First of all, we're losing big species, big animals. Animals, especially the ones that we like to eat or that we feel threatened by, slow-growing plants and animals, the blue whales and the elephants that take a long time to mature, that have a low intrinsic rate of increase, can be especially savaged by the elimination of reproductive adults and increases in their mortality rates. Animals that undergo long-distance migrations are particularly sensitive as well, specialized endemics who live on islands. And we know all this because of what we've seen already in terms of past extinctions. We've lost the ivory-billed woodpecker, in all likelihood. It lived in river-bottom forests across the southeast and in Cuba, and those forests were all cut down. We're losing the bigger elements of genera. We lost the elephant bird in Madagascar, the giant moas and kiwis in New Zealand. We're losing bigger snakes much more often than we're losing smaller snakes. So the first prediction you can make is that we're moving towards a planet with smaller things in them. We're losing things that occupy restricted ranges, things that are endemics. This is what makes the tropics so precious to us and so important to conserve. Many species in the tropics have very narrow ranges. They're adapted to local circumstances. And eliminating that local range, a Sentinella Ridge in Ecuador or a desert pond in the southwestern United States, eliminates a whole species or many such species. This is a desert pupfish. We're losing wide-ranging carnivores. These are what John Turborg calls the big things that run the world. It's not just that they're flagship species for organizations like the World Wildlife Fund or Defenders of Wildlife. We're talking about species that increasingly we're discovering play a crucial ecological role in maintaining dynamic relationships with their prey animals and between prey and the substrates and resources they depend on. The St. Lucia parrot is in big trouble, and the dodo is already extinct. These species had the fault of living on islands and being large and relatively slow maturing. We know that Madagascar is home to lemurs. This is extremely important to us as humans and as evolutionary biologists because lemurs represent a basal group of primates. That's our own group. These are our cousins. And yet the largest ones went extinct when that island was first colonized by the Polynesians thousands of years ago, and many of the others are now severely restricted and threatened. Tenrex. The tuatara is on its own evolutionary limb on the tree. There's nothing else close to it. And yet that's restricted to a few small islands around New Zealand now. So let's look at this context. If the twigs being pruned are the big wide-ranging things, the big things that run the world, the habitat specialists, the endemics, the case-selected species, then we need to understand the context and what the changes in that context represent in terms of threats for those species. These environmental changes have cascading effects. And we tend to look at these, in the last 20 or 30 years, mainly in ecological terms. But I'll argue that it's time we start looking at them in evolutionary terms as well. Evolutionary responses tend to occur at different rates, depending on life history traits. Bacteria are really good at keeping up with us. They've got generation times that are measured in hours. Whales and elephants have generation times that are as long or longer than ours. And anything that has a long generation time is intrinsically going to have a much harder time adapting. Not surprisingly. But another thing I want to emphasize is that a lot of these evolutionary changes, I mean, if we're radically changing the selective context for most species in the world right now, we have to also appreciate the fact that a lot of those changes that are going to occur will not be to our liking, and that many of the changes that occur will be impossible to reverse. They'll be what some people refer to as hysteresis. The system can't go back the same way it goes forward. So here's an example of some of the ways in which this evolutionary context has changed. We've converted wild, natural, untamed, and risky landscapes for tamed, contrived, subdivided, fragmented, and safe landscapes. We've got wild plants and animals increasingly being displaced by domesticated livestock and crop species. We have gradual collective selection, being the first artificial selection by early farmers, being replaced by high-speed, conscious, directed selection at the hands of plant and animal breeding experts. We're substituting a few patented elite varieties in these crops for the broad array of land races that have generally supported our agriculture historically. We've got world trade and globalization replacing local patterns of subsistence and trade. And we've got fossil fuels with their accompanying climatically changing greenhouse gas emissions substituting for human and animal power. Now, what's interesting about these changes to me is that they're not minor, they're not few, and they're not happening one at a time. They're all big, they're many, and they're all happening at once. They're having profound effects, and they're often interacting in ways we barely comprehend. So, in terms of global selective forces, we have massive changes to the Earth's land. Over 40% of the world's land surface has already been cleared for agriculture and cities. Over 80% of the world's land cover has had human disturbance to a greater or lesser extent. And as I mentioned before, we're now commandeering some 40% of the plant primary productivity available for other species for ourselves. Water degradation. Water use has tripled in my lifetime. A lot of that's being used to raise crops, not always in places that are sensible, like the arid lands of Southern California. We're co-opting freshwater flow. No surprise that freshwater species are among the most imperiled in North America. We're seeing massive changes, not just in North America, though, but also in places like the Aral Sea in Asia, which is a ghost of its former self, a very sad case of the overuse of water for irrigation. And I hope there's a lesson to be learned there, although few seem to be paying attention to it. The Great Lake Compact, for example, is currently under consideration by the states in the Midwest, but this state itself has yet to pass it. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is now larger than the state of New Jersey and increasing. This is hypoxia, lack of oxygen, resulting from massive runoff of soil, organic nutrients, and fertilizers from the agricultural heartland of North America, leading to toxic algal blooms of some species and depleting oxygen to the point where all fish and generally higher invertebrate life die as well. We've seen massive changes in the chemistry of the planet. People, a lot of scientists now are busy trying to understand how plants are going to be responding to all these changes in available carbon in the atmosphere and in the climatic shifts that will result from this. We also have terrestrial and aquatic eutrophication. There's enough nitrogen coming down. Now, humans are actually contributing as much nitrogen as all natural processes combined. We are a biogeochemical force. We're also facing, and here's where evolution really comes in, a broad array of novel biological threats, new biological interactions. Globalization of trade combined with the rapid evolutionary ability of many of these species means that we're entering a realm where we can expect the regular periodic emergence of new diseases, new epidemics, and their rapid spread around the world. These are just some examples of unexpected outbreaks of pest species or diseases in recent years. Be ready for more, and be ready for a lot more, potentially. At 6.6 billion people, we represent quite a resource for a lot of species to use. Landscapes like Florida are among the most radically transformed in North America. Florida is sort of ground zero for a lot of invasive weedy species. Some 30% of the species now are estimated to be non-native, and small wonder. Look at it. We've replumbed the Everglades. We've radically transformed those landscapes. We've sucked off water to Fort Myers in Miami. And it's hardly a surprise that Florida Bay is becoming more saline and that reefs are dying. This is the way our landscapes tend to look around the world now from space. This is the Bolivian Amazon, but a picture like this could represent a broad array of other places as well. We've got introduced species below the waterline as well as above the waterline. Here's an invasive that's carpeting the Mediterranean now, apparently released from an aquarium in southern France. And this leads me to sort of another theme here. And if there's anything original in today's talk, this is probably it. This idea that this descent tree, which we can compute fairly readily now using various statistical algorithms, gives us also a glimpse into what I call a context tree. Every species evolved in a context, a particular constellation of other species around it, a set of biogeochemical conditions, a certain climate, and so forth. And this is what's all being radically altered now. And what it means is that most species are going to experience difficulties in trying to adapt, and many are not going to be able to adapt in time. G. Evelyn Hutchinson wrote a classic paper, and I can never remember the title of it because it sort of makes sense either way, the ecological theater and the evolutionary play, or the evolutionary theater and the ecological play. The point is, these are not distinct anymore. We used to think that evolution occurred slowly and gradually, and that ecology was sort of the study of real-time events. That's no longer true. Evolution is happening in real time. Evolution is happening fast, and it's affecting ecological interactions. This, I was humbled to actually see this first tree of life sketched by Darwin in 1837 at the Darwin exhibit this past year. And of course, his colleague in discovering natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace, was another individual. And both Darwin and Wallace, I think, had a deep understanding of this context. It was Wallace's understanding of biogeography and Darwin's metaphor of a tangled bank that emphasized to them how evolution represented an extremely complex process of adaptation and co-adaptation between species and a broad array of other species in their environment. The problem is we don't have any hard bone fossils in our sequence data to tell us what that context was when that species started to evolve. So we're left to ponder what species may be resilient. I mean, species are resilient. They've adapted to a remarkable series of challenges in their environments over a historical time. We see great storms and hurricanes and tsunamis and one thing and another, wiping out life, which is then quickly, even Krakatoa, the explosion of an island, quickly recolonized by individuals from elsewhere. And yet at the same time, that nature has this remarkable resilience. It's peculiarly sensitive to many of the changes that we're throwing at it now. And that's because context matters, because history matters. Species are adapted to resist, withstand, tolerate disturbances that have occurred historically over their evolutionary past. They are not adapted to handle the wholly novel and different kinds of challenges that are being thrown at them quickly and in multiple waves and from different directions at the moment. There was a model first developed by R.A. Fisher, extended by Alan Orr and others, regarding adaptation. And this idea is that a very small change in a gene will tend to be about equally likely to be favored or disfavored, an advantage or a disadvantage. But any time a gene changes in a major way, you can almost be sure it's going to have a deleterious effect. We can make exactly the same argument for environmental changes. Small changes are about as equally likely to favor or disfavor any particular species, whereas big changes we can say a priori are likely to upset things and create a challenge for many more species and likely lead to extinction. This was brought home to me as an undergraduate when I was studying a pumped storage facility in Western Massachusetts, and it was an enigma to me to see an area that was denuded and rewatered twice a day, much like the intertidal area in marine systems. And yet, unlike marine systems, where the intertidal is one of the most productive and diverse zones on the planet, we see very low diversity. And, excuse me, productivity in these pumped storage zones. So why the difference? Why if species can adapt and be so productive and prolific in the intertidal, why aren't they doing well in this below this pump storage plant where they get fresh water every day or every other day? And finally the answer dawned on me about 3.6 billion years. So the changing scale and nature of selection is worth paying attention to. Most of us evolutionists like to study natural selection. It's in the bottom right-hand corner there. A few of us who are plant and animal breeders study artificial selection, which is the intentional substitution of human agency for natural selection. But we're reaching a situation now where we have a lot of unintentional artificial selection going on, where there's what I call inadvertent selection. And I'd argue that it's likely to give us a lot of unintelligent design. And it's likely to make evolution proceed faster, but not in ways that are better for us, but in ways that are going to make human life and existence harder and less pleasant. So we have examples of artificial selection, but inadvertent selection, what I mean is the evolution of antibiotic resistance and resistance to our pesticides, the willy-nilly evolution of introduced species and they're becoming a plague, a weedy set of invasions around the world. The effects of altered landscapes and cascading trophic interactions. We're changing the selective game, and a lot of the consequences I'm suggesting are going to be bad, not just for other species, they're going to be bad for us too. It's very difficult to study this. Very few people do, first of all. You have a lot of uncontrolled variables. You don't know what the agents of selection are. Lots of factors are changing at once at various scales and so forth. It's an experimentalist nightmare. But to ignore it would be foolish. Applied evolution is also the focus of the evolution initiative here at the University of Wisconsin. We're trying to develop a program in this. It's a very fast-growing subfield. A new journal appeared in applied evolution this year. We had the first conference in this field occurred in California last year, just at this conflict or discussion going on. E.O. Wilson is fond of studying ants. He likes to argue that little things run the world, termites emit their own greenhouse gases and so forth. But as I mentioned before, We're learning more and more about how big things run the world, how losing top predators and carnivores has a set of cascading impacts, as we've seen in Yellowstone National Park, and we've seen in the forests of northern Wisconsin, and fish dynamics and lakes here in the Midwest as well. So let me wrap things up here. This is some of my own research, but I'll spare you the self-indulgent parts of that. So you've seen here that the agents of selection initially included direct overkill, you know, hunting. I included market hunting. That's what drove the passenger pigeon extinct and almost the bison. We've got the bushmeat trade today and exotic medicines, of course, being huge, the pet trade. We're seeing fitness declines in small populations. This is something that I study as well. We see fewer seeds and sharp population declines in small populations. You see the prairie chicken in Illinois in great trouble. Its eggs won't hatch, or the young won't develop right until we bring in prairie chickens from South Dakota, where it turns out then you can genetically rescue the Illinois population because you're bringing in genetic diversity and masking deleterious mutations. So twigs are being pruned. Twigs are connected to larger branches, and we're lopping off, or at least we seem to be at the threshold of lopping off whole limbs of the tree of life. Agriculture is a huge experiment. Globalization is a huge experiment. Here's an example in the southern Wisconsin landscapes of how these landscapes have changed. Okay, and we'll give you a little bit of our results. So we're seeing big changes. We're seeing losses of understory plant diversity. These are this is in the forest that's still there. This is the forest that looks intact. It's emptying out a species and it's homogenizing. The forests are becoming to resemble each other more and more. They're losing their uniqueness. In the Northwoods, what we're losing are the pretty species. And it's not just happening here. In every single long-term study that I'm aware of, around the world, anyone who's gone back to the same forest 50 or 100 years after it was first surveyed exhaustively has found losses that range from 17 to 66% of biological diversity, plant diversity. So we're hemorrhaging diversity in invisible ways all around us right now, in ways that most people don't appreciate or understand. We're losing all these sets of species. Many of these reflect changes in context and an inability to keep up with the pace of change that's going on right now. Small populations are particularly vulnerable to these effects, both genetically and demographically. Again, I think I'll skip over some of this research. Suffice it to say that genetic effects are real in small populations. We're beginning to study them in more detail. You get a fall off in how many seeds can germinate in this beautiful royal catch fly when your population dips below 50 or 100. And there are complicated sets of reasons for this, and many of these genetic factors interact with one another. I don't have to go into that detail. So let's change finally to what's the future going to look like. And the future is going to be a planet of weeds, a planet of already common species becoming commoner, a species of more invasive, weedy exotics moving around the world, a future of more diseases breaking out, including emerging diseases. We're going to have on the tree of life a witch's broom with perfusions in some of these groups that are particularly successful in coping with the conditions that humans are creating around the world. And here again, there's lots of opportunity for creative study of evolution and trying to understand applied evolution. We're trying to understand exactly how much these evolutionary changes are responsible for the magnitude and severity of some of these invasions. Some geologists or bigger thinking sorts of people talk about the coming homogenesis, when life around the world becomes more boring, more uniform, more the same from place to place. We're reducing context diversity. McDonald's and mini malls are everywhere, and likewise our biotic communities are coming to resemble each other more and more. So we can expect that to sort of snowball. We can expect that to have further evolutionary effects on the species capable of taking advantage of it. and we can see further extinctions in those that can't. Until finally, we see in this poster the image of life sort of being on a lifeboat. Somehow we imagine the ship of state can sort of charge forward and we can relegate nature to a few small enclaves. Well, I don't know if that's going to work. So what's the future tree of life going to look like? Is it going to be artfully shaped, small and tame inside an artificial greenhouse? Is it going to be small and well-crafted, something the Japanese might bring to us as sort of an ideal tree of life? Hardy and persistent, you know, inspired by the Krumholtz dwarf gnarled trees at Treeline? Or is it going to be a weedy shrub that poisons and displaces native species like the buckthorn? So the irony of the situation is that we're gaining all these opportunities to study and understand evolution just as we're being robbed of a very large fraction of the world's diversity. Even though it's the best of times for studying evolution, it's the worst of times for understanding what we're doing to the tree of life. So I'm not particularly interested in convincing you to take any belief system or point of view or opinion on this. I guess my bottom line here is that we can't ignore evolution and that we should try and understand both where we came from and where we're going. Thank you very much. Yeah, we just want a few minutes of questions and then we'll have a break.
With respect to genetic engineering that you alluded to, how do you deal with the issue of, I think it's called golden rice, that is, putting vitamin A in rice to help populations that don't get it, help them deal with problems of blindness? This is an example.
No, yeah, GMOs like yellow rice represent a marvelous extension of conventional breeding using these techniques of gene splicing and transformation. I see them as highly ethical, highly appropriate. And yet there's sort of many people who view genetic engineering in the same way that other people view evolution by natural selection. They believe it represents a threat to their either their belief system or their worldview or the world as it should be in their mind. I think it's worth realizing that we can use genetic engineering just like any other technological tool for good ends or not so good ends. And it behooves us to try and develop incentives to do things more like the yellow rice. That was developed with the idea of giving it away and improving nutrition around the world. That's an example, I would say, of proactive evolution for good. But that's not what, I mean, a lot of companies, first of all, aren't doing it to be good, they're doing it to make money. And secondly, a lot of the changes I was alluding to are going to represent uncontrolled kinds of genetic changes that are not going to produce goods for us, but probably bads instead. Yes?
And perhaps an optimistic note. Archaeology has pushed the discovery of cultural humans with big brains back 900,000 years at least. So humans, for a long time, kept their population roughly at 10 million worldwide for perhaps 90% of our history. Somehow, instead of looking at the present, we have to maybe consider what we did wrong and how we got on a destructive track rather than one that was imbalanced with nature.
Well, of course, the answer to that is agriculture, which Jared Diamond has referred to in one of his essays as mankind's worst mistake. He argues that, in fact, nutrition, judged by the bones that we have from those eras, that nutrition probably declined after we became sedentary agriculturalists. It's hard, but it's hysteresis. We can't go back. Once that change has happened, it's going to be very difficult. I mean, who among us is willing to give up agriculture and food to go back and pursue a hunter-gatherer lifestyle? It sounds romantic, but
some Detroit like it.
Yeah. Sharon?
John, I'm struck in driving around the American West at the condition of forests, especially in the national parks. And I don't know how much of that is infestation with insects and things like that, and how much of that has been a change in the attitude towards fires or things like that. But it seems a relatively dramatic change in the last two or three decades in terms of how much of the forests are standing out there that are just burned and wasted. Do you have any comment on that?
This has been referred to as the forest health crisis by some people. In particular, the timber industry would like to go in and tell you that we have to cut down the forest to save the forest. It's true that we've just coming to about 100 or 120 years of active fire suppression. Fires were a natural part of dry western forests. The plants and animals were adapted to those, in particular the ponderosa pine and the other western pines that would typically have a life cycle that would more or less match the time between fires. In many areas, fires were light ground fires that would move through the understory. The trees would be large and well spaced apart from one another. Now we're in a situation where the large trees were cut down. Many of the smaller trees that never experienced fire grew up into what are called dog hair stands. They became crowded. They created ladder fuels that created very destructive crown fires. And it's true that bark beetles in particular cue in on stressed trees and are likely to kill a forest even if a fire doesn't. And again, fire represents a natural control for those beetle infestations, so they've probably gotten worse since fire suppression. It's an excellent example about how humans, by changing the context, in this case the fire landscape context, have radically changed the ecological and presumably the evolutionary conditions for the species inside them.
Yes. Say a word or two about the rapid extinction of amphibians.
Amphibians are peculiarly sensitive to environmental conditions. They have permeable skins, so they're sensitive to a variety of air and water products that can move into their metabolism readily. They're also sensitive to diseases like the chytrid fungus and other infections that have led to developmental malformations that were discovered here in the Midwest. They're considered canaries by some ecologists and conservation biologists, things that can represent what's likely to befall other species. We don't know why the golden toad went extinct in Monteverde, Costa Rica. It may have been increased UV. It may have been an infection. It may have been a drying out due to climatic change. And that's another example of the fact that all these things are changing at once. So we don't know exactly what caused the demise of that species. And increasingly for extinctions, we won't know in the future what really drove something extinct. It was probably the multiplicity of factors. But we would do well to pay attention to frogs and other amphibians because they're often telling us something a bit before other species. Environmental estrogens and gender-bending hormone mimics from various industrial chemicals are also having their effects on both amphibians and reptiles. And I'm inclined to believe that, but it's also thought that some of these deformed frogs occur particularly in ponds that have become eutrophic because of nutrient runoff. And it may be a proliferation of microbes in those under those eutrophic conditions that are causing those impacts. Last question.
My question relates to the diversity and the decrease in diversity and the fact that another big whack might be coming if we don't blow up one of these asteroids that comes this way. I'm really wondering, is it just going to slow down the amount it takes to recreate the diverse environments, the context, and therefore the species, or do you think it's more serious than that? Loss of diversity could set us up for another Permian extinction, but bigger.
There are cascading extinctions that occur. It's been hypothesized that the extinction of the dodo may have threatened a plant species that was dependent on the dodo for seed dispersal. There are probably much better and more examples in hundreds of other cases. So there's no doubt that there is a cascading nature to extinction. Some of what I'm cataloging in northern Wisconsin represents the extirpation of plant populations in response to the extinction of cougar and gray wolf and consequent overabundance of white-tailed deer And so, yes, it is a cascading process. Others, I mean, I think we probably are at the end of the evolutionary story for large mammals. Some people talk about a taxon cycle, and they say, well, it's inevitable that small, unspecialized species will be the ones to give rise in the future to newer, larger species. And in general, small mammals are not threatened by extinction. Certain many individual species are. But as a group, small mammals aren't threatened. But collectively, large mammals are threatened almost everywhere they exist around the world. So that evolutionary story may be ending. But the other evolutionary stories will certainly continue. And there'll be a proliferation in response to the vacant niches or available resources that will exist in the world in the future. And I don't worry about the human species. I mean, we're a large mammal. Humans are so resourceful. We have so many cultural resources, and there are so many of us. I'm not worried that humans will go extinct. I'm worried more that they won't go extinct sometimes.
Thank you very much, Don.